will speak to us today on geophysical, wait for the title to come up here, Developing Planetary Exploration Geophysical Systems. Drew.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, I wanted to start by saying, for those of you who know me, no offense to everybody else, I wish I wasn't here right now. And for those of you who don't, by the time I get through all these slides, you may also wish I wasn't here. But I want to talk a little bit about a project that I've been working on through the Johnson Space Center with some folks down there. It's the Planetary Exploration Geophysical System, and basically this was a program that was kicked off within the astronaut office to try to work out some of the problems associated with geophysical systems that we may need for eventual lunar exploration or return to the moon. I want to thank Matt, who's listed there at the bottom, for instigating this work and getting it all rolling and helping author many of the slides. Which, just this one? Okay, so one of the issues that we're looking at for geophysical systems for the moon is we want to build a system that's sort of all-encompassing to include seismic, gravity, magnetics, electrical, ground-penetrating radar. But the key to all of these components is that they have to be low mass and low volume. And of all of those geophysical methods that I listed there, the one that carries the largest penalty for mass and volume is the seismic systems. However, seismic also offers us the best capabilities in terms of imaging the subsurface of our planet, and we'll do the same, and Jack and a couple other folks have alluded to this as well, that we need some good seismic information to understand the crustal structure and the deep structures of the moon and eventually of Mars. So we're trying to go after this, the program of developing a comprehensive geophysical system, but what we thought was the largest problem in all this was the seismic and tackling that problem. So I put this slide up, or actually Matt built this slide for us, which shows the current location of all the active seismic crews in the world right now. And what this illustrates is really that seismic is offering the biggest bang for the buck and is used right now and has been used historically to explore our own planet extensively. I talked about some of these things. One of the goals, so we're trying to tackle the seismic problem, and the way we tried to do that was to drive the development of commercial off-the-shelf products and components to build systems that we could utilize for this type of exploration. There has been planetary seismic operations in the past. We've already talked about a few of those, and I won't go into a lot of detail because I just don't know a lot about them. But we have passive experiments where we're listening for seismic activity on those Apollo missions listed, basically listening for moonquakes, Saturn IV boosters. I think we had impacts. Was that true for those?
Yeah,
and also Saturn IV Bs. Okay, and also astronaut movements. And we were somewhat effective on starting to understand the structure of the subsurface, but not really if you compare it to today's standards and capabilities with seismic operations. We also had some active seismic experiments on Apollos 14, 16, and 17, and I'm sure Jack would be happy to talk about those at length later, but also not a lot of hardware, and everything was limited primarily because our sensors were all attached to the acquisition devices by cables, and that's something that we wanted to get away from in this project, and so I'll talk a little bit more about that. What we're really trying to do is look at ways to develop systems for active seismic exploration. In other words, go out there, lay out sensors, and generate some active seismic sources so we can really get a good understanding of the subsurface through reflection seismic and refraction seismic. We need repeatable point source and receiver locations. We don't have array capabilities because we just can't take that sort of hardware. So we need to develop different techniques both in processing and survey design that will allow us to be efficient and effective with the way we design these surveys. We probably won't take explosives, although we took explosives on the Apollo missions and they were effective, but what we were envisioning for these for these systems is something that could be broad-ranging, do near-surface, small-scale seismic operations as well as broader regional, either tectonic-type applications. So the seismic source is something that's going to be important. But for what we did for these simple tests was simple sources, primarily hammer seismics is what it amounted to. We want to have the capability for in the field QC and processing or quality control so that astronauts in the field can look at this data and understand where they may need to move the surveys around or how they need to redesign the surveys real time, being able to think on their feet and not rely necessarily on what the mission control is talking, you know, telling them about how to lay the surveys out or where they need to go next. And one of the key aspects of all of this is field deployment, operation, retrieval of the system. Just looking at some of the videos that we're showing, you can see how difficult all this is going to be. So the thought was, how do we make this these systems more efficient and more effective for astronauts to lay these seismic components out? So we had some testing objectives. The first of which was to look at the comparison between wired systems and wireless systems. And we wanted to influence commercial off-the-shelf development of components to see if we could get the hardware that we needed just by working with contractors in the seismic industry and seeing if they would be able to help us get to where we needed to be. We wanted to look at volume and mass, the different aspects of limiting the volume and mass of these of the systems components, and integrating the data acquisition hardware with exploration prototype hardware, so EVA suits, vehicles, and comm systems, and that's something we can talk about a little more later. But we tried to integrate these tests with ongoing tests of other planetary exploration components. So we did essentially four tests, three in at Barringer Crater near Flagstaff, and one small test in the dry valleys of Antarctica. The hardware that we used were essentially 10 hertz geophones. We had a conventional cable recording system provided by OU Geospace and a wireless recording system which was provided by VibTech, which is now, I believe, owned by Sercel. We used a accelerated weight drop source, which is a Digipulse RAM-driven elastic weight drop. And I provided the source for the sledgehammer in various locations. And processing was done with Jedco and Paradigm software, and Matt was involved in a lot of the work when he was with Paradigm doing seismic processing for us. This was our original concept for what we thought our geophones should look like, and for scale, if you can think of a Coke can, that's what we thought, that's what we still think, an individual seismic station about the size that it should be. And basically you'd either have an analog geophone or a digital geophone at the base with a spike, and on top you'd have all of these components which basically amount to power supply, a transmitter, positioning device, and signal conditioner for sending the data. The first test I talked about was Barringer Crater. Many of you are familiar with what Barringer Crater is and where it is. We did three surveys. The first in 2004 was a wired and RF survey. It was much longer, about 1,000 or just about a kilometer. The other two surveys in 2005 and 2006 were significantly shorter. And we tried to evolve the systems as we went along with each test. Each year we went out into the field with slightly different components to try and to get to that target, which was low mass, low volume RF systems that could be deployed and by astronauts in suits and then deployed and recovered easily as well. So this was the test in 2005. You can see there's a pickup truck full of cables and geophones, and that stuff weighs a lot. I don't know how much it weighed, but it was way too much to put on a spaceship to send to the moon. But we had, again, a 1 kilometer line. And in the picture on the right, you can see Matt and I standing at the back of the pickup truck with the seismic source. And in the foreground is an RF box that was provided by VibTech. And the bottom box is a battery case. The top box is the data acquisition unit with the RF transmitter in it. And in the bottom in the box was a lead acid battery. So these things are not only large in volume, but they're also very heavy. And the picture on the left is, of course, me stringing out geophone lines. And that's just not something you can do in a suit. It's not possible. So we really wanted to drive that point home, was that if we wanted large surveys, we're going to have to get away from the cabled systems. This is just the seismic data we acquired, just to prove that we actually did acquire seismic data, and we were somewhat successful. And I'm not going to talk about it more than just say, here it is. I thought it looked pretty good. Matt and I did some analysis of it. But the goal of the project really wasn't to look at the data and investigate the subsurface. For us, it was to look at the hardware and drive the hardware development. So, but we did want to prove that we could acquire data and it was reasonable. The next test was a sort of a last-minute effort that I was able to head down to McMurdo and go into the dry valleys with Bruce Marsh of Johns Hopkins University in 05, and it was a program where there was 25 scientists from around the U.S. and international as well that spent some time in McMurdo. And I was sort of a late add and was fortunate enough to carry some seismic hardware down there with me. And the hardware was based on the components that were developed during the 2004 test at Barringer Crater. So what I asked the VibTech to do was provide me with a portable RF seismic system, and they did that. Unfortunately, what they gave me was two 80-pound Pelican cases. So in Antarctica, by yourself, as a one-man seismic crew, you're not very effective or efficient with two 80-pound cases of gear. So we had to use a helicopter to get around the different areas, and there was two study areas. This is one, which is an area just to the north of the Dias formation. And it's sort of a talus slope, and what I did is took the hardware out there. The helicopter dropped us off. It was myself and one other individual, and they said, "See you later. We'll be back in 5 hours. Good luck." And so I had this big sledgehammer and these two 80-pound cases, so myself and an assistant laid out the surveys, and I had four sensors. I had four geophones and one RF transmitting box, which is in the bottom picture, is in the white, and there's that battery case again next to it, the small one. And essentially what I did is I built a refraction line or a velocity survey. We set up the source location in one location, laid out the four geophones, smacked the hammer a few times, recorded the data, and then moved the geophones meter spacing. We kept moving the geophones farther and farther away from the source and essentially built a refraction line throughout the day. And it actually worked, and I'll show you that we required some data at the end. But one problem I did have was that the system caught on fire. So that was bad. That happened within about the first 10 minutes of setting it all up, and there was a grounding problem with the hardware. It turns out the system, they said it was a late add, so the guys, VibTech was out of the UK, and they were working on 240, and I was working on 120, and there was a grounding problem with the batteries and whatnot. So needless to say, when the case started smoking after I turned it on, I thought there was a problem, pulled it apart, and found a lot of burn traces in the board, but with some duct tape and some scavenged wire. I don't think I actually fixed it, but the system essentially worked, but there was some timing problems. So one of the other things that this test illustrated was that you need some additional tools in the field and some knowledge of how the hardware was built in order to be able to cobble it back together if something goes wrong. But we were marginally successful with this test in Antarctica, and in fact, this is the survey. It was about 100 meters long in total, and the section on the right is basically the velocity, the refraction survey that we put together with Matt's creative processing help. We're able to clean this data up significantly and show what we think is a good representation of what's going on in that area. So there was a lot of other data collected. Not all of it was processed just due to time constraints. But we were successful, I think, in that test in looking at sort of a one-man seismic crew, how you might go about this, but also the limitations of the hardware and really where we needed to get with it. So in 2005, we went back to Barringer Crater again with 25 channels. And this time, building on the experiences of Antarctica, we asked the folks supplying hardware, VibTech, to build a system that was much more portable. So unlike in 2004, where there was some fiber optic cabling involved in these systems and also a very large, what amounted to a desktop computer and an additional component for acquisition, they minimized everything into a tablet PC. So the acquisition system and all the triggering and data acquisition was built into a tablet PC with an RF receiver in it. And all the boxes on the left in the picture are the there was 25 stations. Those are still too big, but now the acquisition system itself was built on a tablet PC platform, and we laid out a seismic line, and this time we tried to integrate it with the other testing that was being done in Flagstaff with the first generation Scout rover. In the picture on the right, laser pointer, there's the operator right there, an individual from VibTech. And he is, at this point, sitting there with his laptop PC and acquiring the data as we drag the DigiPulse seismic source along with the big, thick aluminum plate we're dragging behind the rover as well. And we acquired some seismic data. So, again, the seismic data wasn't the highlight of the investigation. It was really the hardware and how we're trying to integrate that with the components that were already out there. In 2006, developing on what happened, the work we did in 2004 and 2005, we're now driving ourselves to a much smaller seismic base station. So our geophone acquisition sensor is getting a lot smaller. You can see the footprint here is in the back of this little mule truck, this little ATV, whereas the footprint in this survey is much larger. And each of the components are much larger. Looking for scale, we've got two boxes here with a battery unit and an acquisition unit. And in this picture, everything is limited to what's in the back of this little pickup truck. Also, you can see for scale, the geophone still is not integrated, but there's a little GPS receiver on top of these and a small battery unit inside. I think they were lithium ion at this point, with much better capability, much smaller mass, much smaller volume. And also now we're integrating being in the suit and acquiring the seismic data on the second generation rover. And this is me in the suit with the acquisition tablet PC as part of the rover itself. And I'm essentially driving the rover and acquiring data at the same time. And we're transmitting that back to a base station. And we've reduced the mass and volume of the system significantly from where it started in 2004. So one of the other things we did was remotely operate the seismic system and the rover from a separate control system van called the ACES Advanced Cockpit Evaluation System, which is basically a combination of real video and mapped images that are overlaid on these screens that have a 180 degree wraparound feature, and we can drive the rover from this vehicle. And here's my seismic acquisition stream screen down here. So we're acquiring the data from those RF sensors, passing it back to this vehicle, which was, I think, about a quarter of a mile away, just for limitations of the field area we had to work in. But we were successful in that as well. So again, this was an attempt to integrate with what's going on. And here's seismic data, just to prove again that we did acquire some seismic data, and these are just some shot records. And in the area, we had some pretty strong subsurface flat-lying reflectors. But again, that's just to prove the point that we acquired it. The other thing we did, as I mentioned at the very beginning, is we're trying to integrate this as a geophysical exploration system. So not only to include seismic, but also other geophysical systems. We had some folks from UT come out and also some grad students come out to acquire a ground-penetrating radar survey, and we did this in conjunction along the same line that we acquired the seismic data. So this really wasn't as much of a integration with the rest of the tests as it was just a demonstration of technique for others involved in the testing at the time and for people to see what we were talking about when we were talking about building a geophysical system. So conclusions, it's possible to have a one-man reflection refraction crew, only with the wrong hardware, it's pretty challenging to get a lot of data acquired. Surface transportation is required to deploy the system. So a couple of other people have mentioned it already. We need rovers. We need some way to transport this stuff around, no matter what its mass and volume is. You just can't acquire large amounts of data in a short amount of time if you have to walk everywhere to place geophones. Accelerated weight drop worked pretty good for us. I don't know if that's something we'd use for planetary exploration. And it's possible to do in-field processing and analysis. We showed that by acquiring the data real-time on the rover and then also being in the control vehicle, the control van, and receiving data from the field as well remotely. I already talked about the problems with mass and volume. What we'd like to do is continue development and integration of the state-of-the-art wireless seismic system. So we'd like to continue to drive commercial off-the-shelf products to meet our needs. I think it's also beneficial to the seismic industry as a whole if we can drive or help drive them to products and devices that are of lower mass and lower volume. It helps everybody. It pays off here on Earth as well. We'd like to look at digital geophones for improved bandwidth and dynamic range. We need to do a better job of putting header information into the file so that we can process the data in quicker fashion in the field. And also, one of the key aspects is we really need to integrate ground penetrating radar, gravity magnetics, and electrical methods to complete the PEGS package, which is really in its infancy, but something we wanted to get something going and get people thinking about the direction we need to go with geophysical systems. So that's it.
Time for just one question. Clive, in the back.
What do you mean when you say low mass? It seems a very old system you have right now, even the one that you have to reduce down. You're able to get the low mass. And how are the engines being powered? Is it one battery or?
Well, I mean, all of that's yet to be seen. In terms of low mass, that's a relative term, and I just think about the picture I showed you with the pickup truck full of all the gear. And in the end, the last picture I showed you was the little mule, you know, the little ATV with all the geophones in the back of it. So to me, that's going to low mass, and it's really just a generic term I'm using. I don't know what it is, and part of that's going to depend on what Constellation program defines for what the payload can be. In my mind, low mass is as small and lightweight as we can possibly make it, period. And so that's going to be impacted by what the power supply is, and some of the things that we were looking at were thermoelectric devices, as well as lithium-ion batteries and solar panels, all built into that single component. So different ways to scavenge power and to power these things. And then part of it's going to depend on what the power requirement is of the transmitter itself and what you actually put into that little box. So low mass and volume are relative terms, but in my mind, it's as small and lightweight as we can possibly make it. Period. And it was nice to see that the contractors in the industry actually moved in that direction over the 3 years that we were working with them, driving them to that product. They went from something that was pretty bulky and big and unusable for our efforts to something that was actually, getting to be reasonable for us. Did you have a second question, Clyde, I think? Was that it? Okay.
Thank you, Drew.
Okay. Really, explosive safety issue?
Well, I don't know. You used them, didn't you? No, not at all. And we mentioned that just because we didn't do a lot of work on sources. We wanted to find a source that we could purchase cheaply and get out there in the field and use. So
I thought it had been eliminated from the possibility.
No, I should retract that and say it's not eliminated, but I'm not sure what the source will be. It may be explosive. I guess it depends on, more work needs to be done on that.
Notice the office getting risk averse.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right, and more work needs to be done. This was really just the early stages of trying to move it forward, so I agree with you there.
Okay, we'll have to move on. Thanks, Drew.
Welcome.
Our next speaker is Kip Hodges, director of the School of Earth and Space Sciences or Space Exploration at Arizona State University, and Kip's going to speak today on the technology-enhanced human exploration of the moon.